There were 16 dead buffalo, lying strung out along the line of the herd's flight. On each carcass, the belly had been split open to let the vultures in, and the sirloin and fillet had been expertly removed. "He killed them just for a few pounds of meat?" Deborah asked incredulously. "That's all," David confirmed grimly. "But that's not bad. Sometimes they'll kill a wildebeest simply to make a fly whisk of its tail, or they'll shoot a giraffe for the marrow in its bones." "I don't understand." Deborah's voice was hopeless. "What makes a man do it? He can't need the meat that badly."
"No," David agreed. "It's deeper than that. This type of killing is a gut thing. This man kills for the thrill of it. He kills to see an animal fall, to hear the death cry, to smell the reek of fresh blood." His voice choked off. "This is one time you can be thankful you cannot see," he said softly.
Conrad Berg found them waiting beside the corpses, and he set his rangers to work butchering the carcasses.
"No point in wasting all that meat. Food there for a lot of people."
Then he put Sam to the spoor. There had been 4 men in the poaching party, one wearing light rubber-soled shoes and the others barefooted.
"A one white man, big man, long legs. 3 black men, carry meat, blood drip here and here."
They followed Sam slowly through the open forest as he parted the grass with his long, thin tracking staff and moved towards the unsurfaced public road.
Here they walk backwards, Sam observed,
and Conrad explained grimly.
"Old poacher's trick. They walk backwards when they cross a boundary. If you cut the spoor while patrolling the fence, you think they've gone the other way, leaving instead of entering, and you don't bother following them."
The spoor went through a gap in the fence, crossed the road and entered the tribal land beyond. It ended where a motor vehicle had been parked amongst a screening thicket of wild ebony. The tracks bumped away across the sandy earth and rejoined the public road.
"Plaster casts of the tire tracks?" David asked.
"Ah, waste of time," Conrad shook his head.
"You can be sure they are changed before each expedition. He keeps this set specially and hides it when it's not in use."
"What about spent cartridge shells?" David persisted.
Conrad laughed briefly. "They're in his pocket. This is a fly bird. He's not going to scatter evidence all over the country. He picks up as he goes along. Nah, we'll have to sucker him into it."
And his manner became businesslike.
"Right, have you selected a place to stake old Sam out?"
"I thought we would put him up in one of the copies near the String of Pearls. He'll be able to cover the whole estate from there, spot any dust on the road, and the height will give the two-way radio sufficient range."
After lunch, David loaded their bags into the luggage compartment of the Navajo. He paid the servants 2 weeks' wages in advance. "Take good care," he told them. "I shall return before the end of the month."
He parked the Land Rover in the open hangar with the key in the ignition, facing the open doorway, ready for a quick start. He took off and kept on a westerly heading, passing directly over Bandelier Hill and the buildings amongst the mango trees. They saw no sign of life. But David held his course until the hills sank from view below the horizon. Then he came around on a wide circle to the south and lined up for Skakuza, the main camp of the Kruger National Park. Conrad Berg was at the airstrip in his truck to meet the Cessna, and Jane had placed fresh flowers in the guest room. Jabalani lay 50 miles away to the northwest. It was like Squadron Red standby again, with the Navajo parked under one of the big shade trees at the end of the Skukuza airstrip, and the radio set switched on, crackling faintly on the frequency tuned to that of Sam's transmitter, as he waited patiently on the hilltop above the pools. The day was oppressively hot, with the threat of a rainstorm looming up out of the east, great cumulus thunderheads striding like giants across the bushveld. Deborah and David and Conrad Berg sat in the shade of the aircraft's wing, for it was too hot in the cockpit. They chatted in desultory fashion, but always listening to the radio crackle, and they were tense and distracted.
"He's not going to come," said Deborah a little before noon.
"He'll come," Conrad contradicted her. "Those buffalo are too much temptation. Perhaps not today.
But tomorrow, or the next day, he'll come.
David stood up and climbed in through the open door of the cabin. He went forward to the cockpit.
Sam, he spoke into the microphone, can you hear me?
There was a long pause, presumably while Sam struggled with radio procedure. Then his voice, faint but clear,
I hear you, Nkosi.
Have you seen anything?
There is nothing.
Keep good watch.
Yebo, Nkosi.
Jane brought a cold picnic lunch down to the airstrip. They ate heartily, despite the tension, and they were about to start on the milk tart when suddenly the radio set throbbed and hummed. Sam's voice carried clearly to where they sat.
He has come.
Red standby. Go, go, shouted David, and they rushed for the cabin door, Deborah treading squarely in the center of Jane's milk tart before David grabbed her arm and guided her to her seat.
Bright Lance, airborne and climbing. David laughed with excitement, and then memory stabbed him with a sharp blade. He remembered Joe hanging out there at 6 o'clock, but he shut his mind to it, and he banked steeply onto his heading, not wasting time in grabbing for altitude, but staying right down at treetop level. Conrad Berg was hunched in the seat behind them, and his face was redder than usual, seeming about to burst like an overripe tomato.
Where is the Land Rover key? He demanded anxiously.
It's in the ignition, and the tank is full.
Can't you go faster?
Conrad growled.
Have you got your walkie-talkie? David checked him.
Yeah.
It was gripped in one of his huge paws, and his double-barreled .45 Magnum was in the other. David was hopping the smaller trees and sliding over the crests of higher ground with feet to spare. They flashed over the boundary fence, and ahead of them lay the hills of Jabalani.
Get ready, he told Conrad, and flew the Navajo into the airstrip, taxiing up to the hangar where the Land Rover waited.
Conrad jumped down at the instant that David braked to a halt. Then he slammed the cabin door behind him and raced to the Land Rover. Immediately, David opened the throttle and swung the aircraft around, lining up for his takeoff before the Navajo had gathered full momentum. As he climbed, he saw the Land Rover racing across the airstrip, dragging a cloak of dust behind it.
Do you read me, Connie?
Loud and clear,
Conrad's voice boomed out of the speaker, and David turned for the grey ribbon of the public road that showed through the trees beyond the hills. He followed it, flying 500 feet above it, and he searched the open parkland. The green Ford truck had been concealed from observation at ground level, again in a thicket of wild ebony, but it was open from the sky, for Akkas had never thought of discovery coming from there.
Connie, I've got the truck. He stashed it in a clump of ebony about half a mile down the bank of the Lutsani stream. Your best route is to follow the road to the bridge, then go down into the dry riverbed and try and cut him off before he gets to the truck.
Okay, David.
Move it, man.
I'm moving.
David saw the Land Rover's dust above the trees. Conrad must have his foot down hard.
I'm going to try and spot the man himself. Chase him into your arms.
You do that.
David started a long climbing turn towards the hills, sweeping and searching up and down. Below him, the pools glinted, and he opened the throttle slightly, seeking altitude to clear the crests. From the highest peak, a tiny figure waved frantically.
Sam, he grunted, doing a war dance.
He altered course slightly to pass him closely, and Sam stopped his imitation of a windmill and stabbed with an extended arm towards the west. David acknowledged with a wave and turned again, dropping down the western slopes. Ahead of him, the plain spread, dappled like a leopard's back, with dark bush and golden glades of grass. He flew for a minute before he saw a black mass moving slowly ahead of him, dark and amorphous against the pale grass. The remains of the buffalo herd had bunched up and were running without direction, desperate from the harrying they had received.
Buffalo, he told Deborah, on the run. Something's alarmed them.
She sat still and intent beside him, hands in her lap, staring unseeingly ahead.
Ah! David shouted. Got him! With blood on his hands!
In the center of one of the larger clearings lay the black beetle-like body of a dead buffalo, its belly swollen and its legs sticking out stiffly as it lay on its side. Four men stood around it in a circle, obviously just about to begin butchering the carcass. Three of them were Africans, one with a knife in his hand. The fourth man was Johan Akkers. There was no mistaking the tall, gaunt frame. He wore an old black fedora hat on his head, strangely formal attire for the work in which he was engaged, and his braces crisscrossed his tan-coloured shirt. He carried a rifle at the trail in his right hand, and at the sound of the aircraft engines, he swung round and stared into the sky, frozen with the shock of discovery. "You swine! Oh, you bloody swine!" whispered David, and his anger was strong and bright against the despoilers. "Hold on," he warned Deborah, and flew straight at the man, dropping steeply onto him. The group around the dead buffalo scattered as the aircraft bore down on them, each man picking his own course and racing away on it. But David selected the lanky, galloping frame with the black hat jammed down over the ears and sank down behind him. The tips of his propellers clipped the dry grass as he swiftly overtook the running Akkers. He was set to fly into him, driven by the unreasoning anger of the male animal protecting his own, and he lined up to cut him down with the spinning propeller blades. As David braced himself for the impact, Akkers glanced back over his shoulder, and his face was muddy grey with fright, the skull eyes dark and deeply set. He saw the murderous blades merely feet from him, and he threw himself flat into the grass. The Navajo roared inches over his prone body, and David pulled it round in a steep turn, with the wingtip brushing the grass. As he came round, he saw that Akkers was up and running, and that he was only 50 paces from the edge of the trees. David levelled out, aimed for the fugitive again, but realised that he could not reach him before he was into the trees. Swiftly, he sped across the clearing, but the lumbering figure drew slowly closer to the timberline, and as he reached the sanctuary of a big leadwood trunk, Akkers whirled and raised the rifle to his shoulder. He aimed at the approaching aircraft. Although the rifle was unsteady in his hands, the range was short. "Down!" shouted David, pushing Deborah's head below the level of the windshield, and he pulled open the throttles and climbed steeply away. Even above the bellow of the engines, David heard the heavy bullet clang into the fuselage of the aircraft. "What's happening, David?" Deborah pleaded. "He fired at us, but we've got him on the run. He'll head back for his truck now, and Conrad should be there waiting for him." Akkers kept under cover of the trees, and circling above him, David caught glimpses of the tall figure trotting purposefully along his escape route. "David, can you hear me?" Conrad's voice boomed suddenly in the tense cockpit. "What is it, Connie?" "We've got trouble. I've hit a rock in your Land Rover and knocked out the sump. She's had it, pouring oil all over the place." "How the hell did you do that?" David demanded. "I was trying a shortcut." Conrad's chagrin carried clearly over the ether. "How far are you from the Lutsani stream?"
"About 3 miles."
"Oh, God, he'll beat you to it," David swore. "He's 2 miles from the truck, and going like he's got a tax collector after him."
"You've not seen old Connie move yet. I'll be there waiting for him," Berg promised.
"Good luck," David called, and the transmission went dead. Below them, Akkers was skirting the base of the hills, his black hat bobbing along steadily amongst the trees. David kept his starboard wing pointed at him, and the Navajo turned steadily, holding station above him. Other movement caught David's eye on the open slope of the hill above Akkers. For a moment he thought it was an animal. Then, with an intake of breath, he realized that he was mistaken.
"What is it?" Deborah demanded, sensing his concern.
"It's Sam, the damn fool. Connie told him not to leave his post. He's unarmed. But he's herring down the slope to try and cut Akkers off."
"Can't you stop him?" Deborah asked anxiously, and David didn't bother to answer. He called Conrad 4 times before there was a reply. Conrad's voice was thick and wheezing with the effort of running.
"Sam is on to Akkers. I think he's going to confront him."
"Oh, God damn him," groaned Conrad. "I'll kick his black ass for him."
"Hold on," David told him. "I'm going around for a closer look."
David saw it all quite plainly. He was only 300 feet above them when Akkers became aware of the running figure on the slope above him. He stopped dead and half lifted the rifle. Perhaps he shouted a warning, But Sam kept on down, bounding over the rocky ground towards the man who had burned his children to death. Akers lifted the rifle to his shoulder and aimed deliberately. The rifle jumped sharply, the barrel kicking upwards at the recoil, and Sam's legs kept on running while his upper torso was flung violently backwards by the strike of the heavy, soft-nosed bullet. The tiny, brown-clad body bounced and rolled down the slope before coming to a sprawling halt in a clump of scrub. David watched Akers reload the rifle, stooping to pick up the empty cartridge shell. Then he looked up at the circling aircraft above him. David may have been mistaken, but it seemed the man was laughing, that obscene, tooth-clucking giggle of his. Then he started off again at a trot towards the truck. "Connie," David spoke hoarsely into his handset, "he just killed Sam."